Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the actor and director Barry Rutter. Founder and artistic director of the Northern Broadsides Theatre Company, he puts on plays in non-velvet spaces with northern voices. The work ranges from the classics to new dramas, and the locations can be anywhere from Skipton Cattle Market to a Roman amphitheatre in Austria. His impatience with convention might be something to do with his beginnings. Although the eldest of four boys, growing up in Hull, he never knew his siblings, living with his father, a fish porter, in a house with one bedroom and no books. He loved boxing and rugby till the moment, aged 15, when an English teacher persuaded the gobby Rutter to take part in a school play. From there, it was on to the National Youth Theatre, where, he says, he fell in love with the rock and roll of Shakespeare's text. One of his most prominent recent successes was casting and directing Lenny Henry as Othello to widespread rave reviews and sell-out performances. However, he says of himself, "I'm still a front-of-cloth merchant. I do love to be on a stage. I like the renewal of theatre every night." So welcome, Barry Rutter. The renewal and, I'm presuming, also probably the presence of an audience are two of the most important things about that.
Yes, but also the ephemeral nature of theatre. I love the fact that it goes,
yes,
and it disappears, and you learn from it, but you can't carry it with you because the next night audience is always new. That's the real magic for me.
Northern Broadsides was set up in 1992, and as I mentioned, I think they were your words, or certainly in the description of it being set up. This, northern voices doing sometimes classical work, but not always, in non-velvet spaces.
I know, it's got a bit moribund, that phrase. I mean, in the beginning, we did non-velvet spaces because that was the inspiration for setting up the company. And it was that excitement of doing a classical piece written by Tony Harrison in front of a natural-sounding audience and using my own voice.
Northern Broadsides, then, your company, does it matter if people, I mean, can people work in it, actors and actresses, without having a northern accent?
Yes. It's not that rigid. At first, I made a joke about it, like Muhammad Ali said, what's my name? We're Northern Broadsides, we're northern, where's your passport? And that's daft, that's silly.
Can I talk for a moment about the performance at Skipton Cattle Market?
They were amazed because these are the same Yorkshire Hill farmers. You know, we talk about diversity now. Back in the 90s, diversity was Yorkshire Hill farmer who bought a sheep on a Wednesday, and in the same ring, the next night, he bought Shakespeare from us. Antony and Cleopatra, Romeo and Juliet, the mysteries. These were people who never went to the theatre.
And so you know for sure that they were your audiences? Did you talk to them?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And that was that wonderful letter that I got from a farmer who said, "Dear Mr. Rutter, loved what you did last night. I'm sorry we can't come to your next one because we're lambing."
Tell me about your first piece of music, Barry Rutter. What are we going to hear?
All the parties that we have, Northern Broadsides, in the 24 years we've been going. If this time arrives and I'm still up, I always sing this song, just because I know the words. But, I've chosen my songs because if you drop a pebble in the memory pool, then all the ripples.
Yes.
And this is the memory of the last 24 years. And this encapsulates Northern Broadsides.
And tell me, what time in the morning might that be?
In the song, so let's...
Okay.
It's the first line of the song.
Ah, yes, let's hear it.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend.
One for my baby and one more for the road. That was Frank Sinatra singing it there. But Barry Rutter, you said it tends to be your late night, early morning party piece if you stay up.
Exactly at 3:15.
Exactly.
And it's only because I know the words, but it's become a little bit of a ritual, so that's nice.
You've played King Lear, I think, twice in your career.
Yeah.
Jonathan Miller directed you a couple of years ago, and he said of you, he's impatient with the gilded world of conventional theatre. He said you are as impatient as he himself is. Is he right? And what is it about you that has been, throughout times, impatient with the status quo?
This assumed scholarship, where, you know, you sit round a table and discuss every bloody line and comma for a fortnight before you get on your feet. You know, rehearsals. First day, act one, scene one, get on your feet and let's get to work. It's that, you know, I love the rock and roll of the big language. And, you know, it is about music as well. The music of language. It's not about the last 200 years, which has been the investigation into the mind and psychology. And what is Cleopatra thinking at any one? Who cares? Who gives a damn? Shakespeare didn't write that 400 years ago. He knew actors he was writing for. He knew the place he was writing for. And he wrote theatre.
So you would contend, it seems to me, that it's all about the story and not about actors and actresses tying themselves in knots about what's the motivation.
Who gives a damn about any actor becoming somebody? That's not our job. Our job is to instill in an audience that what comes out of our gobs deserves to come out of them. And therefore, then you do the work as the audience.
I suppose an actor, if they were sitting here who, you know, sort of departed from your view of things, would say, well, if I understand where he's coming from psychologically, and I'm walking around my kitchen in the morning, you know, making a cup of tea as Falstaff, then I understand what it is to be him. I understand his motivations. I understand the depth, and that is then translated into the performance on stage. You would say
claptrap.
Right. Let's have your second piece of music then. Tell me about this. What are we going to hear now?
My mum used to put these big crinoline dresses on, with an old mac on the top of it, her erring curlers and a net, and she'd go off and sing in the working men's clubs in Hull. And obviously she'd come back in a taxi because she'd been paid. She'd do her hair at the club and then sing two sets of four songs or something like that. But she had this bright lemon dress, I remember. I was only five, and this bright lilac one. And she used to sing this song. And this is the pebble of the few nice memories I have of being a little lad.
The wheel of fortune goes spinning around. Will the arrow point my way? Will this be my day?
That was K-Star and Wheel of Fortune. You said, Barry, going into that very memorably for you, you said it's one of the very few nice memories you have of being a little, and you were aged five around about that when your mother would go occasionally to working men clubs to sing, and she would be in these lemon dresses or purple dresses. What else do you remember about your mother from those early years?
Well, I've got a very checkered history, and my mum's still alive, and I'm eldest of four boys, all to different fathers. And then 17 years after the divorce to my dad in 1966, she came back to Hull and married my dad again.
Right.
And then got divorced again.
Right.
So I've got my sort of rose-tinted glasses on a little bit.
OK, we're all allowed those, I think.
Yeah.
You didn't know your brothers as you were being brought up. How come?
We were off. We were...
You went off with your father?
Yeah, but then when I was five, my mum was married and then had what was number three child. And then when my dad was in hospital in 2002,
right,
I stayed overnight in this room, and this guy came and knocked on a door in a white coat. He said, oh, hello, Bar. He said, I thought it were you. He said, no, I work in radiology. I went, yeah, go on. He said, well, I thought it was your dad's x-rays that come down, so I thought I'd come and say hello. I went, yeah, go on. He said, I'm Michael, the next one to you.
Goodness me. 2002.
First time I'd met him.
Did you stay and talk?
Not really. I was concerned about my dad.
So you were brought up without your brothers, but with your father. Tell me about that early, early relationship with your dad.
My dad always had hopes for me not to work on fish dock, because I'm a fish dock lad from Hull, right near the fish dock,
And those would have been jobs that would have been handed down because they were good jobs.
Excellent jobs.
Yes.
But he didn't want that for me. He wanted me to be a marine engineer on big boats. And I had no physics. I had nothing. But I did get into grammar school. And I was the only grammar school lad down the street. So I suffered with that because my granny wouldn't let me drop trousers till I were 14. So my great tree trunks of thighs were...
In shorts.
Mm. Walking down the street in my uniform. And I couldn't go out larking because I had homework to do.
Let's have some more music, Barry Rutter. Tell me about this. We're going to listen to your third.
Well, you can't be on a desert island without this voice. It is the voice of post-war pop music, for me. And it's obvious who it is.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please telephone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
Elvis, don't be cruel. Barry Rutter, you've spoken about your dad. There he was working on the docks. I think he mostly at the fish docks did night shifts.
Yeah.
How much did you see of him when you were living with him then as a boy?
Well, because of circumstances, I had to share a bedroom with him till I was 18. So he had two alarm clocks. He got up at midnight to start work at 2. He'd come back for breakfast about 7:15. We'd meet for breakfast. He'd go to bed. I'd go to school.
So not much?
No.
You are a very well-read man now, of course, able to quote chapter and verse and some of the finest words that have ever been written in the English language. And yet, you sit in front of me as somebody who, as a little boy, didn't have any books in the house.
Not a sausage. There was a daily newspaper, a weekly thing called The Titbits, and the News of the World on a Sunday, and that were it. When I got to grammar school, it was like I'd gone to Samarkand, and I used everything.
Did you? You gobbled it up, all that.
I did. I did, but in my own tear-arse way. So I was never a great popular with the teachers, except this one guy later on when I was 15, because I had the chippy attitude of the fish dock. So I got aggro at school, and I was a grammar school boy down my street.
And you went to the boxing club?
I was about 12, and I made the mistake of telling the lads at the boxing club and the trainer that I was leaving the boxing club to go and sing in Holy Trinity Church Choir and all.
Oh,
well, he put everybody in the ring with me. Smacked me up. I mean, not badly, but smacked me up. So I left a sort of wimpy betrayer, and I arrived at the first choir practice the next day with elastoplast over my eyebrow, elastoplast at the top of my nose, and a cut lip. So I arrived a hooligan, and I never recovered from it. And I've always had that sort of juxtaposition often in my life. When I went to Scotland to the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, they told me I talked funny. I was the only Englishman in a group of Scots, and they're telling me I talked funny.
I'm sure you did, Barry.
I did.
Speaking as a Scot,
I know.
Sure you did. When you weren't at school, hoovering up all the knowledge and being a tear-arse, as you so wonderfully describe it, when you did have time with your dad,
yeah,
what did you do together?
Films. He was a big John Wayne man, so we saw everything John Wayne did. We saw everything Jimmy Cagney did.
When was it that you started going to the choir?
Oh, when I was about 12. And I still had a soprano voice. And then when it broke, it didn't break in any quality.
And were you the one who decided you wanted to go there, or did somebody pick you up?
Yeah, somebody at school. I mean, the music teacher at school said Holy Trinity are recruiting. And they accepted me.
There was something in you, even though you were chippy and conscious that you wanted to fit into your surroundings, there was something also that was lusting after this other world.
I liked performing. I'm not saying I was good. I liked being in front of an audience.
And you knew your mother had been a singer, because you'd see her go out in the lemon dresses.
In the clubs, yeah.
Do you think maybe you were sort of connecting with some of that? I can sing too, I can do that.
Not
too.
That as much as her confidence of standing up in front of an audience.
Time for more music, Barry Rutter. Tell me about your fourth. What are we going to hear?
I was always a Stones fan. From the first moment they came out, I was a fan. I was also a Chuck Berry fan, so I've made a compromise here. A Chuck Berry number sung by the Stones. It ain't the Stones' bestest, it ain't Chuck Berry's bestest, but together it's quite dynamic.
In the heat of the day. I'm
That was the Rolling Stones and Let It Rock. And I mentioned to you, Barry Rutter, during that, that this was the first time it had ever been chosen on Desert Island Discs. The same as K-Star, that track too. You were happy with that.
Oh, aye.
Yeah.
Original.
Tell me about Mr. Siddle.
The English teacher. He was trying to persuade me to come into the school play for a number of years. And then he said...
For a number of years?
Yeah, well, a couple of years at least. Because the staff played the leads in the play then. And then he said, look, you've got a big gobbing class. Put it to use in the school play. And eventually, having said I'm too busy doing football, I'm too busy doing cricket, etc., I went into the school play. And that was the first year, because there were two of us that he took a particular theatrical shine to that could carry the play, and it was the government inspector. So I played the mayor, and this other guy played Chlestakov, the government inspector. And I loved it.
Is that where you feel most at home?
Yeah. Oh, without question. Without question. It's the best drug in the world. Not that I've done drugs. It don't go with the stage. It's as simple as that. It's just that marvellous feeling. I mean, you know, the holy trinity of acting is head, heart and balls. And, you know, it thrills every part of it.
Tell me then about joining... You auditioned for the National Youth Theatre.
Yeah.
What do you... I imagine maybe as much being around people who you maybe felt for the first time, oh, they're like me, this lot.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a dustman from Plymouth, I remember, 1964, and his council were so thrilled with him that they'd paid all his expenses to come to... That was a different world. You know, it didn't cost me a penny to go down to London.
What Again, happened? Did you just apply for a little grant?
I applied for a local grant and a trust fund. And, you know, then it was a real achievement, except I knew that I didn't want to be a student in London. When it came to it, I only applied to provincial drama schools. And I took the first one that took me, which happened to be the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama in Glasgow.
And how did you get on there? You said they tried to iron your accent out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen, in 1965, I was in the famous Antony and Cleopatra with Helen Mirren at the Old Vic. 1966, we redid Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs at the Royal Court. That's when George Harrison bought the rights. And I was in that with Tim Dalton. And then I went back to college. And they sort of patted me on the head and said, yeah, very good for that West End in the summer, but now you've got to act properly. And I said, sod off.
So you left?
I left early. Yeah, because I got a job round Europe, playing Nipple in Little Malcolm. First class travel all round Europe, 1968. Of course I left.
Let's have some more music, Barry Rutter. Tell me about your fifth.
Well, at this college... It was combined with the music college as well. And it was really where I got my sexual awakening, particularly the music ladies. And they played violin and got invited to a lunchtime concert. And then I heard this and I just fell in love.
That was part of the third movement from César Franck's Symphony in D minor with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Monteux. We were chatting earlier and you said, Barry Rutter, that I should say César Franck and not César Franck.
It's up to you. I can't say César Franck, but that second one you did.
You were a first-time father in 1973 to your daughter, your first daughter, Tamsin. What difference did that make to your working life as an actor then?
I'm afraid I followed the checkered pattern that my mother did with me, due to circumstances. I won't bore you with what they were, but it was unfortunate, to say the least.
So at that point, it wasn't that there was a family life that was burgeoning. No. You were working and you happened to have a daughter.
Yeah.
So you joined the RSC in 1975. What were the roles that you were playing?
I had a good time. I wished for bigger parts. But again, you know, 75, I remember rehearsing something and I did it in Geordie because it was a servant to Hotspur. But Hotspur was doing it RP. So I got moved from the servant and they got an RP servant in to talk to an RP Hotspur. And I thought, oh, here we go.
Barry, tell me then, how did you meet the woman who would become your wife?
She came backstage in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she was doing her doctorate, to congratulate us, really. I just played Oedipus in Roland Joffé's production of Yeats's version of Oedipus. And I said, oh, you're nice, let's go for a drink. And that was it.
Right.
And then we got married in 78.
You had two daughters.
Yeah.
You also had a son. That was your baby, Harry. And then Harry died at 14 weeks old, died from cot death.
Yeah. I was on stage at the National playing Napoleon in Peter Hall's Animal Farm, 1984. And the corner knew just after the interval. But they couldn't, you know, I'm Napoleon, I'm on and off stage.
Oh,
so
goodness.
The stage manager came into the dressing room at the end and said there's been something wrong. I knew something was wrong because she was smoking and I hate smoking, and certainly in a personal dressing room. But I never in the world thought it would be Harry. So I drove home. And I drove home as fast as I could with the radio blaring all the time. I was wanting the police to stop me so I didn't have to drive. Mm-hmm. And explain the situation and then get the police to take me home, because it was south of Stratford, so it was from the National Theatre to Stratford, the family home. We then went on to have another child, which we weren't going to have. And she's now bright and bonny and is about to be married.
And what sustained you through... people have to be as resilient as they're able to be. What was it through that time? Was it family? Did you keep on working? Did you take time away from
work? Oh, yeah, but 10 days later, I was back at work.
Were you?
On stage. But also, that year, I put on a load of weight because I never said no to anything. If people said, "Would you?" Yes, please. People come up to you and react to you when you've lost a child. And often they offer things.
Right.
You know,
yes.
That old thing of when Priam goes to Achilles' tent for the body of Hector, first they sit down for food and drink. It's that sort of ancient syndrome that you bring food and drink. And I never refused any.
It must surely have changed you, that tragedy.
I have a hole in me which will never get stitched up. It's a black hole. But next to it is the son of the daughter that we now have.
Let's have some more music, Barry Rutter. Tell me about your sixth choice of the day then. What are we
going
to hear?
Well, I am a terrible insomniac. And I used to sing to my girls, Bryony and Rowan, before they went to bed. So on this island, I would love to be sung to sleep. And this is the lullaby that Eliza Carthy was sang to by a Mam Norma.
Cares of the day half fled my little old sleepy head. Stars are in the sky. Time that you press was set my little old sleepy head to a prairie lullaby.
That was Eliza Carthy and Prairie Lullaby. You said you would like that on your island, Barry, because it would help to hopefully lull you off to sleep. You're an insomniac. What do you do in those nights when you can't sleep? Are you reading plays? Are you thinking artistically?
I put Fab Lab on. Through the night, Fab Lab.
You were aged around 46 then when you decided to create this Northern Broadsides Theatre Company.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very interesting age to set up your own company. And I wonder if you can give us a little bit of context for that. Was it because you saw the limitations of what might happen?
It was two big disappointments. And you can only drink so much scotch or kick the dog. You have to do something. And so I did it. I got a sort of Road to Damascus vision. And I set it up. Some people thought I was mad. Some people thought I was stupid. But a lot of people went with my burning enthusiasm. And by sweet serendipity, all my hometown was having its first ever big festival. 700 years of being a city. And that was in 92. So I tapped into that with a production of Richard III in a marina boat shed.
So what would you say to people who, in a very lively way and very often participate in that current debate about, you know, diversity in the arts, widely recognised as being a useful thing in society in broader terms, yeah, who also say that, you know, right now, within the acting profession particularly, what we are seeing are a very high-profile group of performers who may be very able but come from very well-heeled backgrounds, have been through, you know, the private education system and so on, and that this is indicative of the fact that the acting profession can no longer really support people from low-income backgrounds because they just don't have the cash to go to the...
This is part of the elitism.
Right,
I'm not blaming the actors, the good actors, the stars, but the elitism that's happening. It's happening in football, it's happening in our universities with foreign students buying up all the places... And accommodation at universities, it's happening, and it's happening in the arts.
What is it right now that might be putting off youngsters from lower income and more diverse backgrounds from getting into the acting profession?
The whole funding across the board. And every fiscal argument is won. At least £3 or £4 goes back to the coffers of the land for every pound given in subsidy. It's a proven fiscal fact, but that's not the point. It's about the imagination of the country. Once you rob the country of the creative spirit, this is the danger. That's when we become a desert.
Let's have some more music, Barry Rutter. We're on your seventh. Tell me about this one. Why have you chosen this and what is it?
Well, it's a tribute to the ladies in my life, from the matriarchs when I were born, right through to the ladies of girlfriends, to dear ex-wife, to daughters, and to leading colleagues, all of whom have been female. And it's my sort of little nod and tribute by one of the great female rock and rollers. And also, I went to see her in Manchester, and at the end of the show, her climax is this great big mechanical claw comes up and it swings out over the audience, and she stands at the apex of it singing, and she leant over, and it stopped right above me, and she leant over, and I got an anointing drop of sweat right in the middle of the forehead.
Left a good job down in the city, working for the man every night and day, and I never lost 1 minute of sleep,
and I was worried
about the way that things might have been.
You know that
big wheel keep on turning, primary keep on burning.
That was Tina Turner and Proud Mary. As I've mentioned, Barry Rutter, you've played King Lear twice in your professional career.
Yeah.
He dies of a broken heart at old age, really,
yeah,
doesn't
probably,
he?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
have the great parts in playing them taught you about how to do it? You're about to be 70 yourself. What
yeah.
have they taught you about what it is to be older?
Not a lot, because 70 now is a lot younger
yeah.
than when they were written. And certainly, you know, my grandfather's age or even my dad's age. 70's a lot younger now. You know, I'm still putting on a fat suit and falling backwards into a basket 7 times a week. As long as we don't lose our faculties,
yeah.
actors don't need to retire.
Yes.
I just hope I grow old gracefully with a bit of fun and a lot of rock and roll.
In 2009, you had a heart attack, didn't you, while you were touring in Estonia?
Yeah, I did. I was directing Richard III in Estonia. Luckily, in Tartu, the second city, because it's got a university and a lovely clinic with it.
Oh.
So I had this heart attack. I didn't know it was a heart attack. It was a real pain across the top of my shoulders. And I was working for 4 days afterwards. And eventually my designer said, "You're not right. Let's go to the clinic." So straight upstairs, intensive care, straight up to the surgery ward. So I was watching it all on the screen. He gets to the occluded artery and he said to me, "Right, there it is, Mr. Rutter, on the screen. About an inch of occluded blood." He said, "I've got to remove this very carefully now so I don't send it round the body. It's not a 5-minute job." And I said, "Well, Doc, I'm going nowhere. The pubs are shut." He started laughing. And then very formally, he lifted his hands off my body, looked down at me and said, "Mr. Rutter, don't make me laugh. I'm in your heart."
Good advice. Did you heed it?
Oh, I did. Yeah.
And what about the family? People who spend their life in the theatre talk often and apparently honestly about the family of a theatre and being together with other people. Given the confusion of your early life, has that felt like the most solid family?
I don't think it's an accident that I spent National Youth Theatre, Royal Shakespeare Company, National Theatre, and then the last 24 years with my own sort of theatrical family, plus the families that I've helped to create, you know. I don't think that's an accident. if I was psychoanalyzing myself, that's what I would probably think, that I've sought families.
Just a tiny bit of introspection there we got.
Well, listen, if you're on an island, you're going to have a bit of navel gazing, aren't you? Come on.
I was grateful for it, Barry. I was welcoming it in. Tell me then about your eighth track. What are we going to hear?
Well, this is my rage against the dying of the light. I don't want to hang up my rock and roll shoes.
Sure.
This is a great version of a song which is many people have recorded, and it's wonderful brass in the middle of it.
That was The Band and I Don't Want to Hang Up My Rock and Roll Shoes. So, Barry, I give all our castaways, as you might know, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I don't want the Bible.
Right, you don't have to take it. You will take the complete works of Shakespeare.
Oh, well, of course I will, yeah.
And you're allowed to take one other book.
Yeah, now, can I swap the Bible for Tony Harrison's selected verse? And then he's got a book of prose coming out, so can you drone it to me next year?
No.
Three books is three books.
No, you can't do that. I'm not changing the rules for you. It's fine for you not to take the Bible.
Oh, all right.
But complete works of Shakespeare and one
well,
of
I'll
the
Well, I'll have
book.
To make do with his selected verse then.
You will. A luxury item. What's your
now,
luxury item going to be?
I'll be getting old, and so the quality of my death will be important. I wanted to take the NHS, but you won't give me that. So, hanging like a meteor above the lintel of the door of the hut that I shall build will be a pair of swimming flippers. And at the first sign of madness, I'll put them on, swim out, find a great white and challenge him to 15 rounds.
You can definitely have the flippers. And if you could only save one disc from this list of eight, which one would it be?
Well, I'm a rock and roller. It was going to be the Stones, but I think with the memory of all the ladies in my life, Tina Turner.
It's yours. Barry Rutter, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.